evolutionary scientists, when they discover these capabilities, they're just left guessing. They're like, oh, how could this be? It's kind of cool to be on the side where we know that we have a great and powerful God who makes these things be.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. This is Real Science Radio. I'm Fred Williams.
And I'm Ryan Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
Well, welcome back, Ryan. But first, there are two all-time firsts for Real Science Radio, and we're going to get to those in a second. But Ryan, I noticed you've got some new digs there behind you. You're remote. You're normally in studio, but you're now remote. So what's up with that?
Yeah, this is my new studio that I set up for a little show I've been doing with one of my friends about fantasy football mostly, but it's been fun.
Okay, yeah. And so for those interested, it's called the Oil Boys Dynasty. And you guys are actually starting to get quite a following on TikTok, and you're trying to build your YouTube audience. But anyways, so Ryan, you're sitting in today for my co-host, Doug McBurney. He's on that proverbial assignment, which means you and I are going to go through the latest Creation magazine.
Yeah, I'm excited. There's some really interesting stuff in this one, from a spider web with over 110,000 spiders and peacocks shooting laser beams. It's going to be a really good one.
Okay, so, and Ryan, I just found out from Doug, I know people are going to want an update on Walt Brown's ninth edition of the Hydroplate book. Well, unfortunately, it's looking like mid-June now, and I asked Doug, you know, is this book, is it on the wrong side of the Strait of Hormuz? And he said it's a printing problem. They had some kind of printing issue, and it delayed production of the book. So, but that should be on target now for mid-June. We apologize for that. And appreciate the patience for everybody waiting on this long-awaited book by Walt Brown, the ninth edition.
Well, good things come to those who wait, so it'll be really good.
Yeah, and I know you've got to pre-order yourself, so.
And speaking of books, I heard that RSR is coming out with a book that you could call me an editor on it.
So yeah, we're coming out with our first Real Science Radio teaching series book titled Jesus, Light, and Design, and we're expecting that by the end of April. What it does is it pulls in a decent amount of material we've covered over the years with Real Science Radio. I think a lot of our listening audience hopefully will like this book. And we're going to include a hardbook cover version for all of those who pre-ordered Walt Brown's book and everybody who orders his book up through June when we finally can send those out. So again, we're looking forward to that, and we'll provide more details later on it. Ryan, that was one of our firsts, but the other one is super impressive. A first for Real Science Radio is we have a video that hit 1 million views. It surpassed 1 million views. It has well over 100,000 likes. And someone, Ryan, you know, did this video. Your sister.
Yeah, it's an awesome video. Everyone should go watch it. It's about the asteroid that a couple years ago everybody was freaking out about, thought was going to hit and destroy the Earth. It was about that and about its potential linkage to the Great Flood and the Fountains of the Great Deep. So if you haven't seen it, you should go watch it, because it's pretty good and interesting.
Yeah, and we're going to be doing more shorts, hopefully coming soon. And we put out shorts all the time from our videos, but we're going to start making more shorts that are actually produced just to be a short. And Ryan, I know you're going to be helping with that. So we're looking forward to that, plus a lot more from the RSR Media publishing arm, you know, and including we're going to have in the next in the series of books is going to be the famous list of not so old things. We're going to do that in book form. And while we're on the subject, we've added two new books to our store from Ellen McHenry, and I just love her books. And we read everything we put on our bookstore. Everything we have on our store is endorsed by us. So her latest is Sun Puzzles, and it's an alternative look at explaining the sun, because the secular model claims nuclear fusion, all these things, that there's a lot of problems with them. So you can get this book and find out what those problems are and an alternative explanation. It's really, while it's technical, it's easy to read. I mean, Ellen has a really good gift. She has quite the gift for writing books. The other one is The Genius of Glenn Lehr, James Clerk Maxwell. You know, he was a Christian from the 19th century. And it says here, a reader-friendly biography with suggested activities by Ellen Johnson McHenry. So I read this one also, and it's just really good. I mean, she just, again, has a gift for writing. Those you can find at store.rsr.org. Those are new products. And of course, she's done in the past for us. We've also got, you know, this book here, Plasma Astronomy in the Bible. That is so well written. It's a really interesting idea on alternative explanation for the secular cosmology model. So I encourage you to check those books out. They're just awesome. So, okay, Ryan, I guess we should get to the Creation Magazine, the latest edition.
Yeah, that is really cool, though. A lot of great stuff to read and watch.
Yeah, we have RSR Media. You know, we've got a lot of things in the works. So now today we're going to go through Creation Magazine. And this latest edition is volume 48, number 2.
Yeah, and there's a lot of cool stuff in here. As we mentioned earlier, we got the peacocks and the spiders. There's also some blue radiation Chernobyl dogs, or at least so they think. So it'll be fun.
Yeah, so this blue dog from Chernobyl. Now, everybody remembers Chernobyl is the nuclear power plant that, you know, was a disaster. And it's just a disaster zone still, as far as I know. And so that'll be interesting to talk about these blue Chernobyl dogs. You'll want to stay tuned for that.
Yeah, but before we hear about that one, there's something else we can hear about, which they say is a useless ear muscle.
Okay. You know, that's a good story to start with, Ryan. And I wanted to start with this one because your wife, Haley, is a PhD doctor in audiology. And so you kind of have some inside baseball on this, maybe, perhaps, huh?
Yeah, I do. I actually told her about this one, and she read it, and she actually hadn't heard of these uses for those muscles. So even doctors have something they can learn.
Oh, there you go. So what's up with this so-called useless muscle?
Well, it's pretty cool. It's a classic. You got these things that are so-called vestigial structures that they say is useless and is left over from past evolution and just is still around even though it's not used anymore, and that's an evidence for evolution. I remember being in class in college, and they use this as one of their big evidences of evolution, that, oh, there's just all these stuff that's worthless. Well, in the ear, they thought these muscles were, except for, like, wiggling your ear a little bit. But actually, they found they have some potential pretty important uses, like being able to distinguish sound in, like, a room where there's a whole bunch of different things going on, and they help you be able to focus on certain things, which is kind of cool.
Okay, so what you're saying is, like, if you have competing sounds, these ear muscles kind of help you tune in to those sounds that, so you can kind of decipher between all the chaos that's happening, basically?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, I know mine get quite the workout, especially when I'm driving and, you know, with the wife in the car. And, you know, maybe there's a sports event on and she's trying to talk about maybe something her and her friends are doing. So maybe my muscle, those muscles are really trying to sink in on the radio probably. So anyways, okay. So yeah, you know, there's this long history of vestigial organs, and it's really just scientists that, you know, they have this worldview. They go to college and they learn all about evolution. And the next thing you know, they're taught how these certain organs are useless, that so they do really bad things like take tonsils out when they shouldn't. And, you know, they claim the appendix was useless, and now we know that isn't. And here's just yet another example. This is really cool because I had never heard of this one either. I've heard of a lot of so-called vestigial organs that turned out not to be so, but yet here is another one, the muscles on the ear. That's really cool.
Yeah, and it's interesting how they ended it too. They said that more research is needed and more work is needed to figure out more. Which would be kind of great if they used that kind of honest science earlier on, saying, hey, we don't know what this does, but let's try to learn more about it instead of just saying, oh, this is worthless, stamp vestigial evidence for evolution and moving on.
Yep. So those listening to KLTT in Denver, 12:30 every lunchtime hour in Denver every Friday. So as you're driving down the road, if you're listening to the radio and you're getting distracted, hopefully those ear muscles are tuning you into the radio show and also focusing on your drive, or if you're at work at lunch, enjoying a good Real Science Radio. The bottom line here, Ryan, design just keeps winning.
Yep, it always does.
Example. So, okay, the next one is peacocks shooting lasers. Now, what is that all about? Peacocks shooting laser light, right?
Yeah, it's interesting, but it's not, they're not like Superman shooting lasers out of their eyes. It's actually, these scientists applied a fluorescent dye to the peacock tail feathers and then illuminated it. Under those conditions, the eye spots in the tail feathers showed previously unknown optical properties and emitted low-intensity laser light, specifically strong orange at 583 nanometers and weaker green-yellow at 574 nanometers.
So there's this interference pattern going on with these really elaborate structures. And so the peacock, Ryan, it's not walking around zapping the barnyard, right? It's not as if Scotty was yelling, "We need more power, Captain."
Yeah, it's not like you're at the Denver Zoo and those peacocks are lighting people up.
Yeah, they have to have a glass enclosure to keep people from, you know, like they do with poisonous snakes and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's not quite a Federation weapon, but it does mean that these tails are super sophisticated, and they were already really beautiful, and that was a wonder, but they've even got more stuff that we're still learning about.
Yeah, and you know, we've talked about the morph butterfly before, and I've got some specimens in my house, and it's really cool when you look at them at different angles. You know, there's that iridescent light that you see, and it's a similar thing, and they've got these structures on their wings, and if you look at them through a microscope, they're almost like little Christmas trees connected together, and so light hits into these, you know, crevices in the wings that are really precisely designed, and it causes an interference pattern, which is so cool, and then it's, you know, pretty much this nanostructure design of these peacock feathers. It's the same concept, but in this case, there's actually laser light coming out from these eyes inside of, you know, of the feather, you know, the part that's solid. And it's just amazing how that it just bounces light back and forth and then aligns specific wavelengths to create these laser lights.
Makes you wonder, like how can that be explained? We often hear that beauty in nature is explainable by selection, which I still think is pretty big jump. But something like this, these really complex nanostructures that emit low frequency laser light back, like that's how does that come from random mutations over time?
Yeah, exactly. And I mentioned the morph butterfly. We talk about that in the upcoming book, Jesus Light and Design. That one's already in production. It's already with a book formatter. And too bad I didn't know about this story, because this would have been a good one to add to that section. The book talks a lot about light and how it's so important to life in general, how it ties to Jesus and, you know, design. So again, we'll have that book out hopefully by the end of the month.
I guess now you got something for volume two in that book.
There you go. A volume two or a second edition. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And Ryan, it reminds me, this whole thing about peacocks and natural selection, the evolution is trying to explain it, they try to figure out how does this help it survive. It's just so goofy. But when we look at it, we see elegance, precision, and just excess beauty. And it reminds me of a verse that I have on my saltwater tank, a little plaque that says, God made his works to be remembered. And that's Psalm 111, verse 4. And I like how it ends that verse. So it says, He has made his wonderful works to be remembered. The Lord is gracious and full of compassion. So he kind of ties those together. Really cool.
Exactly. And it's fun to know this cool stuff is from the Lord instead of like evolutionary scientists. When they discover these capabilities, they're just left guessing. They're like, oh, how could this be? It's kind of cool to be on the side where we know that we have a great and powerful God who makes these things be.
Yeah, absolutely. So the takeaway here, again, you look at even the peacock feather, the more we learn, the more we find it's not some crudity, but craftsmanship. So, Ryan, the next topic is, giant spider web. This one is amazing. It's 110,000 spiders. Now, what's up with that?
Yeah, it sounds to me kind of like a nightmare, but it is interesting. Yeah, there's this cave where there's these two different species of spiders, and there's 110,000 of them, and they've got this massive, elaborate web that covers 106 square meters, which is about 1,100 square feet. And it's just a patchwork of thousands of individual funnel-shaped webs, and 60% were one species of spider and 40% were another species.
Wow. Okay, so two different spider species, and they're both usually solitary, and they're now living together in what this article basically calls a giant spider megacity. And I Googled I tried to come up with an analogy, and I thought, okay, we're talking to Ryan Williams today. He always does our creation magazines. He's recently started a podcast on fantasy football, so I looked for an analogy with football. It's the same as 2,500 footballs laid side by side. That's how big this web is. So take 2,500 footballs, put them side by side, and that's how big this spider web is. Now, how would you like...
We'll have to get right on talking about that in the next show.
Well, yeah, there you go. So on your next podcast, I expect to see the Oil Boys Dynasty talking about these giant spider webs.
We will.
Well, you know, we live in Colorado, and for 5 years, I lived in Missouri. I called it Misery. One of the things I didn't like about Missouri is if you were walking out in the woods or even by your house or something... I don't know how many times I walked through a spider web and you're like, man, where's, I know that guy's on me somewhere, you know, can you imagine walking into a spider web? That's the equivalent of 2,500 footballs. I mean, walking through that thing and 110,000 spiders. I mean, yeah, that's like a Indiana Jones type movie scene right there. So
I know it, but the explanation of it is pretty fascinating. Basically this cave environment has a bunch of hydrogen sulfide gas, which is the one that smells like rotten eggs. And there's these bacteria that thrive there. And that bacteria is food for these flies, which they call midges. So these flies go and get this food, and the spiders built the web in between so that these flies all get caught in their web. And then they basically got endless food.
Yeah. So, yeah, sounds like the abundance of food kind of changes their behavior pattern, right?
It does.
Yep. Okay, well, the article also suggests natural selection has worked against solidarity for these spiders. So, in other words, this isn't an example of molecules to man evolution. It's an example of creatures exhibiting flexibility and response to a very unusual setting. And I did want to make, you know, an important distinction. This is adaptation. This isn't, again, some kind of long, over billions of years evolution. You know, I want to circle back to natural selection. There's another article that references it, Ryan. Was there anything else on this spider web?
Yeah, I thought flexibility was a good word to describe it, because it doesn't really seem like something where you need new genes. Oh, we need a cool mutation to let this happen. It seems like flexibility. This is stuff that's programmed into these creatures that most of the time they're not going to do, but in the right situation, they will, and they'll coexist with these other spiders to get some food. But one other angle I thought was interesting the article had was, it talks about how the hydrogen sulfide that was in there, a lot of times it comes from decaying organic matter, which creationists have long suggested rapid cave formation that hydrogen sulfide would be evidence of. So just kind of another layer of this story in these cave systems that also back to the Bible has to say.
All right. Okay, so from spider webs to Ryan, it's time for the interesting fact of the week. Are you ready? Oh, and you know, this particular segment is sponsored by Lawrence in Republic, Missouri. So again, if you want to sponsor an interesting fact of the week or sponsor a show, just go to store.rsr.org. And then click on the sponsor link, and there's different sponsorships you can do, and we'll mention yourself on the air, unless you explicitly reach out to us and say, hey, I want to sponsor a show, but don't mention my name. You know, every now and then we get a few that just kind of want to be anonymous. And so anyways, we thank Lawrence in Republic, Missouri. And so Ryan.
This one's for Lawrence, living like Larry.
That's right. So here is the interesting fact of the week. Why do higher frequency sounds tend to be harder for older adults to hear first?
Oh, I actually know this one, I think.
And Ryan, you can't phone a friend. You can't phone Haley, who I think is probably at work now, because I know she would know this answer for sure.
I was thinking, because I'm almost positive she's told me this before, so I should know it. I just can't remember off the top of my head. Let me see. Hold on.
I got my finger on that red button. Yeah.
They hear high frequency. Is it high frequency they have a hard time hearing?
Why do higher frequency sounds tend to be harder for us older codgers to hear?
Is it because of the shape of the ear canal? Maybe gets a little decrepit.
Oh, I enjoy doing that. High frequency hearing loss often happens when the tiny hair cells in the inner ear get damaged.
Really? Interesting. It's kind of, that's almost counterintuitive because old people have all sorts of hair in their ears.
I resemble that remark. Okay. Well, on that note, let's lead into the next story here, which is, this one's kind of humorous. It's Chernobyl's blue dogs. You know, this one got some evolutionists excited because we're like, hey, dogs have evolved. Some dogs can evolve into the color blue. So what's up with this one?
Well, in Chernobyl, as we kind of teased earlier, there's the exclusion zone, and people can't be in there, or else, you know, you get all sorts of issues. But there's some animals that have been in there, so there's different theories of these wolves that maybe or maybe not are immune to cancer or something. But the researchers recently saw these three blue dogs walking around, and as you alluded to, they get all excited. They're like, oh no, this might be some sort of evolutionary innovation. The radiation caused rapid mutations in their cells, and now they're blue. But the article's explanation is a lot less glamorous. It turns out the dogs had tipped over a porta potty, and that kind of nasty blue water they have in there got all over them. They might have been rolling around in it or something. But basically,
so they eventually found out, oh, hey, wait, you know, they're trying to figure out, they're doing genetic studies, whatever they're doing, and oh, look over there, there's a porta potty. It's got blue. They find out that the dogs tipped it over, and that's why they're blue.
Yeah, hilarious.
Oh, man. Yeah, I couldn't resist including that story. That was in the latest Creation magazine. That's pretty funny. So this one captures kind of the problem with science reporting. We see the same thing with the mainstream media. People get eager for some dramatic narrative, and it's just another worldview where they want to believe this mutation leads to evolution story. But in this case, once again, they're wrong, and it was just a ordinary, messy porta potty episode.
I think at least for what it's for those dogs' sake, you know, hopefully, you know, there weren't any people near there for years, so hopefully it was just blue and nothing else.
Okay, so Ryan, the next story is solar system traveling faster than predictions allow. And Ryan, here's one for the astronomy buffs. Researchers say the solar system appears to be moving through space about 3.7 times faster than the standard cosmology predicts. So, you know, this kind of ties to last week's show. So we talked about the Apollo model. It has a lot of promise. And that model, we talk about how space isn't just emptiness. There's something there. And you don't need relative Einsteinian special relativity for this stuff to work. It's a really interesting show. I encourage people to go back and watch that series. There's a lot of technical stuff. But if you watch part three that ends the show, we get more into this Apollo model. So it kind of ties with this whole thing about, hey, they're looking at something that shows it 3.7 times faster. And what's this article, how does it deduce that, Ryan?
Yeah, so it essentially takes signals from distant radio galaxies and similar results from quasars. And they, I don't know exactly how they do it because I'm no expert, but they use that to measure the speed that the solar system is traveling in. And they can use that to determine that it's traveling 3.7 times faster than they expected. And it's interesting because one of the researchers said they need to question fundamental assumptions about the large scale nature of the universe, which it seems like that's something we hear all the time. They always have to change something. They always have some idea as a result of the Big Bang or whatever new theory they like. And they notice something different and they've got to change the whole thing again.
Yeah. How many times we've seen this phrase, question fundamental assumptions.
And, yeah.
You know, of course, creationist angle is that the universe isn't as smooth and tidy as the Big Bang cosmology expects. And, you know, findings like these just keep putting more and more pressure on these guys. And again, I'd like to refer people back to last week's show on the Apollo model. Really interesting stuff. So, you know, every few years, cosmology has to patch another leak. I'd say every few weeks, it seems like. And, you know, we're not embarrassed by that, Ryan.
No, we're not.
We're not embarrassed for them.
It's like the worst boat of all time, always springing leaks in new places.
Exactly. Okay, so Ryan, is there another story you want to cover?
Yeah, I thought the anteater one was pretty good. It's interesting. The question was, did anteaters evolve a dozen times independently? And the evolutionist claim is that there's like 12 different anteater species, and they all had to evolve independently, individually, because they didn't, they weren't close enough to each other to have a common ancestor, or so they call it, I think, convergent evolution.
Yep. Yeah, that's their magic wand, just so story. They like to throw, you know, grab words out of a hat. Oh, convergent evolution. So, you know, and then they try to explain this by saying that ants and termites became much more abundant, so these lineages, these mammal lineages, repeatedly evolved into anteaters because there's more of them. Well, I'm going to evolve into eating ants, and I'll be an anteater. And so they got 12 different independent paths of evolving into anteaters. It's just, it's remarkable to me, Ryan, how people, when they're clinging to a worldview, how they can say this stuff with a straight face.
Yeah, it's crazy. Your move is you see these things couldn't have evolved from a common ancestor. So your next move is saying, oh, they just all did it independently on their own. This major distinction, this huge thing that's pretty unbelievable to happen once. So no, it actually happened 12 times. You're going to cling to that instead of maybe thinking there's a creator.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, they say that the eye has evolved down 40 separate independent paths. And you just look at how complex the eye is. It's remarkable, again, the just so stories and, you know, how they just, again, how they say this with a straight face, but they're so used to believing the fairy tale.
I was going to say, even these ants isn't, you know, like the most simple thing of all time either. It's not like they just have dietary changes. These anteaters have lower body temperatures than most mammals, so they can live in the areas that they're in. They have these long, sticky tongues and specialized claws and stomachs. So this isn't just something that's a dietary thing that they... It evolved 12 different times, the desire to eat ants. There's actually a lot of physical structures that they need to have in order to effectively get their food.
Yeah. And I've always said, as you look at something that man has made, like Ryan, the chips you make at Micron, you know, the NAND storage devices, as you look at them under a microscope, they become more and more simple. It's just like there's more air, there's more space. They just become more simple. But when you look at something that God's created, they always become more complex. So I guarantee you, if you look at this sticky tongue, it's going to get more and more complex as you look closer and closer at it. In fact, what good is a sticky tongue, you know, without the right feeding behavior? You know, the coordination of this whole thing matters. There's you mentioned the specialized claws. All of these things, reduced teeth, altered metabolism that these guys have to have, and they have to have digestive adjustments. This is all an integrated system. It all has to work together, and somehow this evolved 12 different independent times. Unbelievable that they think that that happened. Their faith is blind, unlike ours, which is an intelligent faith. I mean, you have to have a lot of blind faith to think this happened 12 different times, as complex as it is. It's remarkable.
Mm-hmm. All right, so next up, we've got an article about cousin marriage. What's that one all about?
Yeah, so cousin marriage, there's a study, and the article, it begins with a 2025 BBC report on first cousin marriage, and then it digs into this long-running Born and Bradford study. So that study started in 2007 and included more than 11,000 babies. So in the Pakistani group, over a third of the parents were first cousins, about 37%, versus only 1% in the non-Pakistani group, meaning about 1 in 6 babies in the project were born to first cousin parents. And so they did this later follow-up, and they found a measurable disadvantage for children of parents who were first cousins. And what they found is the probability of reaching developmental milestones by age 5 was 54% for first cousin parents versus 64% for unrelated parents. And average primary care appointments per year were 4.1 versus 3, so more primary care visits for kids who have parents who are first cousins.
It's interesting. So the effects aren't enormous, but they are visibly there and measurable, that children with closely related parents aren't hitting developmental milestones as fast as children with unrelated parents.
Yeah. And the study also found that there's a 3-6% increase in birth defects when, you know, first cousins marry. And Ryan, the article gets to the biblical question, which is from what I understand, you know, Ken Ham said this, and he's, you know, he's had all kinds of experience. The most common question you get asked by someone who's not super familiar with the Bible or even by Christians is, where did Cain get his wife? Adam's son, Cain. And so, Ryan, where did Cain get his wife?
Yeah, the article is pretty straightforward about it. Cain's wife had to be a close relative, and you know that Adam and Eve had other sons and daughters. So I think a lot of it is that early on, close marriage is obviously necessary because there's not that many unrelated people out there. But back then, you also have a lot less genetic mutations. So when you are marrying someone who's within your family, you're a lot less likely to pass down the same mutation, which is what causes birth defects a lot of the time. So since there's hardly any mutations at that point in time, you're still pretty unlikely to pass down a defect. And it is interesting because once time went far along, in Leviticus 18, God prohibits marriage with close relatives. So eventually it reaches a point where God sees, okay, we're going to be like, this is like going to cause problems now. So then he just bans people from doing it. Yeah.
Yeah, the genetic load got large enough. And you mentioned Leviticus 18, that's after the global flood. And so this is something where I want to bring up, you know, an important biblical and genetic point. So if humanity began with Adam and Eve, these early generations, as you just mentioned, they wouldn't have any kind of mutation burden. It'd be pretty much minuscule, very tiny. And, you know, we at Real Science Radio, we believe the mutational burden really started to kick in after the global flood. And why do we believe that? We've covered this quite a few times on Real Science Radio. So in Walt Brown's hydroplate theory, the onset of the flood involved violent crustal movement, and it generated these huge electrical discharges in the granite crust. And Brown, Dr. Brown argues that those plasma discharges rapidly produce much of Earth's radioactivity and many of its radioactive decay products. And you can read all about that in Walt Brown's book. Now, I've got his 8th edition over here, but you need to go pre-order the 9th edition. And there's more material now on the radioactivity in his book. And there's modern scientific studies that show how this happens, how you get these effects, plesioelectric effects, and how this, you know, the granite moving, you can cause radioactivity. And I know that, you know, they can reproduce this in laboratories. And again, a lot of this stuff is in Walt Brown's book, and encourage you to get it. If you can, go to store.rsr.org and you can pre-order a copy. And you'll also, in that package, will be included RSR's first ever teaching series book, Jesus Light and Design. So I would argue, Ryan, that it's this huge increase in radioactivity after the flood and, you know, other climate and environmental changes that caused this steady decline of human longevity after the flood. And it got to a point in Leviticus 18 where God's like, okay, this mutational load has got high enough where no more marrying of brothers and sisters and first cousins, any of this, because the mutational load had gotten too high. And you know, it's interesting after the flood just how human longevity just really dropped.
Yeah, exactly. It makes sense because before everybody's living 900 years, but after the flood, it takes a pretty steep decline. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yep. And you know, the article goes further. It talks about how every baby is born with 60 to 100 near neutral. It says near neutral mutations, which means slightly harmful. And it notes that there's over 6,000 Mendelian diseases have been identified. This reminds me, I used to have conversations with Dr. James Crowe. He used to publish regularly for Nature magazine. And he wondered about how we haven't already gone extinct. And this article, they mention evolutionary geneticist Alexei Kondrashov, who asked the same thing. Why haven't we died 100 times over? Well, we would have if humans really have lived for millions of years. The genetic load would have become too much. But we haven't been around that long. But every generation, things get slightly worse. So that's a really good article, Ryan. There's one more I wanted to get to, and that's the loss of scales in Chinese cave fish.
Yeah, and it kind of brings back your call out to natural selection earlier.
Yeah, it does. So basically, this article points out that you've got these cave fish, and they're favorites of evolutionists because in dark caves, we already know that eyes can become reduced or lost. And in this case, the scales also can be lost because they require resources to build and maintain. So in this resource-poor dark environment, losing a feature can actually sometimes be advantageous, right, Ryan?
Yeah, the article mentions the golden lionfish genus Cynocleotelius, found only in and around caves in China. And some species have eyes, and some are eyeless, and some of them have like the little like tiny micro eyes, they call them. And some of them also are scaleless, because kind of as you mentioned, the scales just require a lot of resources to maintain, so if they don't need them, they lose them. And there's this new one, Cynocleotelius zingrenensis, has large functioning eyes, but no scales, and it lives in part of the cave systems that are periodically exposed to light, so it makes sense for it to still have normal eyes.
Yeah, so it kind of breaks a simple storyline, so it's not just cave equals blind, it could be a mix of traits. So, you know, the article refers to where it could infer natural selection, and what's interesting is, you know, this is the Creation Magazine is put out by the guys at Creation Ministries International. Now, they tend to use the term natural selection, you know, within created kind, so totally within a biblical model. While there's ICR's continuous environmental tracking model, and it emphasizes built-in programmed adaptability, we at Real Science Radio, we lean towards ICR's framing of this whole thing. We think it's more likely that it's a lot of these examples are just the design of the genome to be able to adapt and not necessarily natural selection. And natural selection, by the way, was originally proposed by a creationist. It wasn't Darwin that came up. Darwin later used it to try to push evolution along, and we know just how that doesn't work because you lose information over time. Anyways, that's an interesting debate, in-house debate going on between CMI and ICR. It's a friendly debate, and it's a healthy debate. And, you know, again, we'd lean towards ICR's framing, but that doesn't mean either side can actually prove 100% right now. There's a lot of research that still needs to be done.
And really, regardless of who's right or wrong, there's a big difference between losing something and gaining something. They're not growing scales I've never seen before. It's always something that's lost.
Yeah, exactly. So, Ryan, we're actually out of time. So, as always, this was a lot of fun. So, I really like the useless ears that aren't really useless, the useless ear muscles. So, I'll have to, you know, maybe bring that one up to your mom. You know, hey, I got these extra muscles that I actually can hear you better than you think I can. You say, I can't hear you. You know, I'm not listening. I'm listening. And I've got a design that helps me hear some of that stuff you're saying while I'm trying to listen to the football game on the radio. So, again, Ryan, thanks. Always a pleasure to have you on Real Science Radio, sitting in for Doug today. And again, just a reminder, Walt Brown's In the Beginning is unfortunately delayed until June, the 9th edition, but keep an eye out for that. And also, our upcoming first RSR teaching series book, Jesus, Light, and Design. And we're looking forward to starting this RSR teaching series. The book after that will be the list of not so old things. And we have other books planned, AI and creation and a whole bunch of good stuff coming down the pike, Ryan.
Yeah, exciting stuff.
Okay, so for Ryan Williams, I'm Fred Williams of Real Science Radio. May God bless you.